Football Weekly with James Richardson in association with sportingbet.com.
Football Weekly, looking back on a weekend of drama. Premier League, while Lampard and Defoe warm up their World Cup penalty skills, we ask the Stoke Christmas party bust-up, was it another example of police brutality? There's Sid in Spain on Real Madrid and Ronaldo's abs, surely the most frightening waste since Liverpool signed Aquilani. There's Italy, the Derby d'Italia, the Derby of Rome, and why fair play landed Ascoli in trouble. There's Champions League previews post and the return of Fernando Duarte on an extraordinary final weekend to the Brazilian season, knowing him more. All of that in today's Football Weekly. Hello, everybody, then. Crikey, sounds like a very, very exciting podcast today. And I'm joined for it by Kevin McCarra.
Hi, James.
Hi, Kevin. You just back from Eastland.
Yeah, I walked.
And Fernando Duarte, as I mentioned.
Hi there, guys.
Lovely to see you again, Fernando.
Likewise, Jimbo. Mm.
And Barney Roney.
Hello, everyone.
And everyone says hello back to you, Barney. Now, Kevin, hot off the foot from Eastland, and what a big game that was. Does it tell us much about Chelsea? Does it tell us much about Man City?
Well, first of all, I've been to the last two Man City games. I saw them beating Arsenal League Cup in midweek, and I think it's a wonderful place. There's a tremendous excitement in the crowd. The whole sort of Blue Moon stuff they do is good fun before kickoff. And that lovely
tell us about the Blue Moon thing.
Well, I liked it in midweek because being nighttime, they trained a sort of giant blue spotlight in a section of the crowd facing the tunnel with the rest of the stadium dark before kickoff, so the fans become the blue moon, as it were. It's quite, I thought it was very enjoyable and entertaining. But the fans are at that great stage where they know their team is far stronger than it was and the adventure's just beginning. You know, there's no recriminations. Like, you know, if Man U didn't win the league, they'd be fury at Old Trafford. City are still in that kind of young, optimistic, hopeful mood. And at the weekend, they beat Chelsea. It's to beat Arsenal reserves, basically, in the League Cup. But at the weekend, they beat a proper Chelsea team. I don't know if Man City are going to be in the top four, but there's certainly some excitement about the team.
Well, Bergin88 posting in asking for predictions for Man City. So could we just have a quick suggestion as to where they're going to finish this year? Are they top four contenders, Kevin?
I think they are.
You just said you didn't know.
But No, but I can bluff. Yeah, I mean, I don't see, for example, that they're weaker than Spurs, who are fourth at the moment. Yeah. Liverpool, you know, have had their difficulties, might recover. I honestly think Liverpool will finish in the top four and Man City might be fifth.
I have the impression that City can do it. Something's telling me. I mean, it's a very interesting squad. Of course, they need to gel. They need to get everybody in, and I don't think they can actually deal with some serious injury. For example, if they lose Adebayor, I think they're going to be toothless, even with Tevez walking around. Funny thing about Chelsea last night is that they had the kind of blip that could be really costly, especially during the African Cup months. Remains to be seen if they can hold to that top spot.
Fernando's going to say to you, you know, their team cost £50 million more than Chelsea's at the weekend. And part of that, of course, is Robinho, who is playing because Craig Bellamy, who's been really good, was injured. I mean, Robinho, again, didn't go past anyone in the game on the weekend. Do you think he is just not very good, or does he just really want to leave Man City?
Both. I think Robinho has been overrated for ages, even in Brazil. I think he's a very interesting player to have around. And in a time where Brazil is suffering some kind of scarcity up front, he definitely needs to be in the squad. The thing is, if he's not as half as good as he thinks he is, and obviously his lack of motivation is clear. He wants out. Mm-hmm. He wants to go back to Spain. He wants to go to Barcelona. And, you know, he's just dragging his heels there. At least he's not throwing tantrums, which shows some kind of maturity.
Well, we'll be having Sid on the phone, Telefonica, permitting it, as ever later on, to address the Ronaldo and, Robinho and also the Fabregas rumour that's flying around at the moment. Barney, what about you, though? Are you convinced by this sudden return to victory?
Oh, yeah, I agree with Fernando. I think they have a very good chance of finishing fourth. But if they can get Craig Bellamy back and fit as well, who was playing brilliantly, and also because Mark Hughes looks the business this year.
It's a very attacking team, though. I mean, they don't defend with any great conviction. That might be a problem down the line.
Yeah. Now, it was only a week ago that we were applauding Carlo Ancelotti for his frankness in saying, yes, Chelsea can win the league. But now he looks a little bit silly for coming out with such a statement. With the league cut back down to 2 points, Man United, obviously, with a very big win over West Ham, were in all sorts of problems without that fellow Carlton Cole. Man United, though, drama at the back, that injury list in full: Gary Neville groin, Nemanja Vidic flu, Rio Ferdinand calf, Johnny Evans calf, John O'Shea thigh,
Rafael da Silva injury, doesn't say what, just says injury. What a rubbish list. Fabio da Silva groin, Van der Sar knee, Wes Brown limped off Owen Hargreaves knee, and that's how they're going to be facing Wolfsburg.
Well, which is where I'm going tomorrow.
Indeed. You're not walking this time though, Kevin, I imagine.
I'm going to hitchhike my way to the...
All right.
It's an economising period, as you know, at The Guardian, you know. So,
yes.
Interesting if Man U didn't win the group. I mean,
how interesting would it be?
Well, because it wouldn't know until we got the draw, would we?
Yeah.
But let's say they got one of the big boys from Spain in the last 16.
Or another major European nation.
Well, yes, or Italy even.
Well, okay.
You were going to mention that, were you?
Do you think that...
where are the Italian teams in their groups anyway?
There's a very strong possibility that Milan and Inter and Juventus could all finish second in their group.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe Man U would miss them if they were second as well.
Perhaps they would. But so who are they going to have at centre-back? Will it be Evra and Carrick again?
Well, I think there's very few options, isn't there? But the thing is, Wolfsburg are, above all, an attacking team. So I think this is quite intriguing to see how this makeshift defence copes with a well-honed attack.
Mm.
To be fair, it's not a bad time in the season to have your defensive injury crisis. And you know, they've got quite an easy run of fixtures coming up after they get past Wolfsburg.
Very good. Well, listen, on we roll then. Liverpool. You see, we do address the teams outside the big four. Liverpool, Fernando. Ooh, Palau posting and saying, didn't someone say on the podcast earlier this season that Liverpool minus Gerrard and Torres were about the same level as Blackburn? Turns out, says Palau, it should have been Liverpool minus Torres is the same level as Blackburn. You must have been a little bit disappointed with their performance at Ewood Park.
Yeah, to the point that I'm not even watching them anymore. I'm not being a faithful supporter. But in a certain way, it's disappointing, and I'm pretty sure that everybody...
In a certain way, it is disappointing.
And everybody in the red half of Liverpool will be feeling gutted that... You know, after what happened last season when we were within grasp of that famous trophy.
Yeah.
Now we're not even in the Champions League anymore.
Nope.
It just seems that one of these horrible seasons, and that might cost Rafa his job, I think, at the end.
Well, it'd be interesting to see what it would take for Rafa.
They're not going
to
sack Rafa Benitez.
Mm. Who's going to sack him? That's the issue.
I mean, the story is he's due enormous sums of money if they do. His
right.
contract is so watertight, and it's only just been signed in the summer.
Mm.
So whether they can afford to sack him is that... Anyway, it's a bit ridiculous.
They could sell Aquilani and use the money to sack him.
It's a bit ridiculous to talk about sacking him, mind you. He's not done that badly. Runner-up last year, two European Cup finals. People have done worse.
He's not their problem. He's a good manager. I don't know. I mean, would Jurgen Klinsmann coming in really improve the situation?
Well, that's a question, isn't it, Barney? Yeah. Which we don't have time to address right now. We're going to move straight on. Quick nod for Everton, perhaps? Only a point for them at home to Spurs, but it could be a big, big point after their recent run of results.
Yeah, I mean, and they do have that perseverance, Everton. Their squad was very, very weakened yesterday, but they brought on the guy Coleman, who's, I think, said he's young, 21 really, but he played very well on the flank, pushing forward and getting them back into the game. It's funny, I mean, Spurs, you know, what an opportunity it was. And you thought, all right, it's not the first choice defence, but you would have thought that Bassong and Dawson would have held the back four together better than they did. And it did suggest still some fragility in the ranks at White Hart Lane.
Now, further down the table, all sorts of excitements. Hull losing Jimmy Bullard again. The scan, I believe, is today. We'll find out how long that injury is going to be for after his return had proved so inspirational to City. But to Birmingham and Fulham, there were the shout. Fulham now at eighth place, just 2 points behind Liverpool. Birmingham up in ninth place, kind of on the sly a bit. Nobody's really taken much notice of them, but Alex McLeish's side... climbing steadily up the table, and apparently they've got $40 million to spend in January. Is that right, Bernie?
Well, apparently so, yeah. I mean, I know that's the rumour, but they're quite similar teams. They're both pretty well organised, defend well, don't score that many goals. But Fulham I've seen a couple of times recently, and they're quite nice to watch. They have lovely little interplay in midfield. They just really lack a cutting edge.
Right.
As Bobby Zamora seems to have identified by pointing at himself and saying...
The Barry Glendening of the Cottagers, conducting his own one-man campaign against the blog miscreants.
Reads a lot of blogs and they're upset.
Well, what's the issue there? They've been having a pop at him on the internet, have they?
On the Fulham website, apparently, there's been some swinging criticism of his goal record.
I was for Birmingham, by the way. Alec McLeish is a great organiser, but the weekend they scored 3 goals, sort of cutting loose a bit. Maybe they're getting more confident. They're now, in the top half of the table? They must be close to it.
Ninth place. Ninth.
Was it Benitez's first goal? I think it was, wasn't it?
Oh, that sounds right, yes.
Mm. And that's why people love the
I believe he scored against Liverpool.
I think two from Sebastian Larsson as well.
Yeah, that's right. Mm.
But that's why we became so much in love with the Premiership in Brazil, is that you see the smaller teams, doing damage.
Right, you don't see that in Brazil?
Championship. No, of course, with the level of footballers, and we do see that, but we love to see that in Europe because the Italian league is becoming more and more predictable in the Spanish league as well. But in England, there's always some kind of like crazy match.
Don't you think it's funny
match.
Hearing that? Because I always think of the Premier League as being a very predictable league.
Yeah, what you're talking about, Fernando, is not an end-of-season positions. You're talking about single match results, and that is more true in Italy than it is in the Premier League, I would suggest.
Yeah, but we'd like to see, for example, you know, this thing, Birmingham scoring three goals and you know, some crazy 9-1 results. You never see that in Italy.
I can think back to an 8-2 and an 8-1 and some 7 this is and that, etc., etc., etc. You do see some extraordinary results. It was a 4-4 the other day. It was an absolute stonker. I do agree. There are a lot of goals in the Premier League, and there is a certain carefree abandon to a lot of the play that makes it a very, very easy on the eye product. And I use the word advisedly. Now, very, very good. I haven't mentioned Stoke yet. Arsenal, amidst their injury crisis, managing a win over Stoke City. And then what happened, Barney Roney?
Well, there was a minor disagreement between BT and Pulis. Punches were apparently thrown.
Yes.
It's surprising because Pulis has actually been very good for BT and good for his career. I mean, he signed him from the Championship. Yep. He plays him in most games. BT's actually done very well. He normally speaks very warmly of him. But it was something to do with the players not being allowed to go Christmas shopping.
No, James BT had spent 2 weeks, apparently, organising the Stoke Christmas party. He could have just got Rio Ferdinand on the line and got him to sort the whole thing out. Then Tony Pulis, after the defeat at Arsenal, said, right, you're all coming in to train Monday morning. And Beattie was furious because apparently he had arranged Christmas party on the understanding that he would have had Monday off. Is that right, Kevin McCarron?
Yes, although wouldn't you think you could train and then go on to your party afterwards? No.
They were going out on the lash in London.
In London.
Somewhere Stoke Newton, obviously. Mm.
So apparently James Beattie is a bit of a spokesman. You've probably read all this on the internet yourselves. Anyway, he stood up to Pulis and Pulis was furious and tried to headbutt him was one allegedly.
Really?
Was
he wearing his cap at the time? He could have caught him in the eye.
I think headbutting James Beattie should be a national obligation for every British citizen, you know.
Fernando, why?
Because he's an idiot, basically.
Is he?
Yeah.
What's wrong with James Beattie?
Yeah, he's a failed footballer who's been like milking small clubs all over the country, you know, never fulfilling his promise. Sometimes he's fat as a force-fed pig. And now he's fighting because of a Christmas party. Headbutt him, guys.
Can I say, by the way, I got the Arsenal score correct and picked the score, which is almost unknown for me. That's how obvious it was that Arsenal were going to win by a comfortable, not huge, but a comfortable margin.
Should have factored that into the Christmas party.
Yeah, I just kind of wonder why Tony Pulis thinks this is outrageous that they lost 2-0 to Arsenal at the Emirates and there must be a punishment exercise, a reprisal.
I don't know, but I do know that there was a lot of post-match tastiness all over the world of football this weekend, particularly in Brazil, with some actually awful consequences. We'll talk about that later. But in Scotland, there was that Hamilton Hearts game. Mm. Did you know about that, Kevin?
There was a huge fight in the tunnel. Although I saw the Hamilton manager saying, oh, yeah, there's something going on, but that happens all the time, he said. Huh. I think they're now saying, oh, it's okay, the referee sorted it, please don't take any further action. They're scared of an SFA investigation and bans being handed out all around.
All right. Are you Inter as well, with a little bit of Buffon getting Thiago Motta by the throat? It was all quite...
Really?
Quite
was it proper fighting, or was it kind of slightly weedy?
It was a bit weedy, actually. Buffon and Thiago Motta, that looked quite serious. There's a bit of previous with them. We'll get onto that in a second, shall we? I think we've covered pretty much everything there is to cover in the Premier League. Coming up, though, where we're going to be turning our attention to the Champions League, more games from that. Sid Lowe in Spain, a bit of Italian stuff, etc.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.
It's all go here at Pod Central. We've got Sid Lowe's answering machine on the line, so while we're waiting for the great man to be in range or whatever, I'll just crack on, shall I? Hey, Italy. We were mentioning the situation there with the big three in Italy and their Champions League prospects. Juventus are taking on Bayern Munich at home. Big game that as well for Bayern's manager, Van Gaal, who says it's a decisive game for Bayern, but not for him. The impression, though, among German football experts, i.e. Raphael Honigstein in his column that I read over the weekend, is that that's far from being the case and that the management at Bayern have taken their distance. In fact, I believe Uli Hoeneß was saying that he's going to be reviewing Van Gaal's position over Christmas. Of course, they're taking their Christmas break in a couple of weeks. So, huge game that. Juve just need a draw to qualify. Bayern need the win. Also exciting to note that in the Bundesliga, struggling Stuttgart have finally sacked Marcus Babbel and brought in you know, our man with the tube pass, Christian Gross.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's exciting, isn't it, Kevin?
Yeah, I can see why they're unhappy with Martha's Babel. I don't know what they think of Christian Gross. I think he's just going to sort of steady the ship. You wouldn't see him as being an inspirational figure who's going to shoot them up the table, would you?
No, not necessarily, no. Anyway, that's the situation with Juve. They come in, though, on a real high to this clash with Bayern because, of course, Saturday night in Italy was the Derby of Italy, Derby d'Italia, and they beat Inter 2-1, which kind of reopens the Italian title race a little bit. It brings Inter back to within range at the top of the table. They're now 5 points clear of Juve and just 4 clear of Milan, who were on fire in a 3-0 defeat of Sampdoria earlier that day. And all sorts of tension in that game. Mario Balotelli, who is probably the least popular player in all of Italy, and the impression is building that he does need to leave the country if he's going to get a little bit of mental peace, because Juve fans hate him, and the week was spent in Turin appealing to the fans not to do the nasty chants they do about jump up and down and then Balotelli dies, which is a rough translation.
Why do they hate him so much?
They hate him for lots of reasons, for previous in games with Inter and Juventus. Balotelli, I must say, is not doing anything to endear himself to anyone. Never smiles, argues with his own teammates. And when he came on, I think about an hour into the game, first thing he did was barge over a Juve player, then stand over him and shouting and pointing his finger, claiming he'd dived. So, of course, that only increased the amount of whistling he was receiving. But a cracking goal in that game from Marchisio. Delightful to see the young midfielder back for Juventus. And it was a brilliant goal. And, as I say, it kind of reopened the title race. Mourinho got sent off. He was very upset about Juve's opening goal. He will be back though on the sidelines as Inter take on Rubin Kazan. And they need to win to be absolutely sure of going through there. They still run the risk of not qualifying if they don't get the right kind of draw or lose to the Russian champions. But they do have Wesley Sneijder back, which is huge because they've never actually lost with Sneijder in the team. They look a completely different outfit when he's playing. Rome derby, Roma won 1-0. Lots of people posting in saying how much they enjoyed the game. I have to say, didn't think it was that special myself. Leeds and Lazio just 1 point off the drop, and in all sorts of problems. There was a lot of violence outside the stadium. Lazio fans unhappy. The game was suspended for, I think, 10 minutes or so in the first half because one of the sets of fans kept throwing sort of homemade bombs at the pitch and all of that.
Homemade bombs.
Yeah, they're these homemade kind of, they're bangers, but
right, not a kind of ice cream, form of Italian ice cream.
La bomba. No, not that kind. The kind
an actual bomb.
The kind that blew off a linesman's hand once in a game down in Salerno.
Right.
So that's not too much fun. So the referee kind of stopped it, and the whole first half was not so good as a result. What else was I going to say about Italy? Well, we were mentioning Milan. They've got a big game away to Zurich. Whose 1-0 win at the San Siro represented really the nadir of Leonardo's early season at Milan, but they really turned it around, and they do just need a draw, I think,
in
that game.
Isn't he walking on a thin rope there, Leonardo? Mm-hmm. What's the situation? I mean, the impression I have is that...
No, everybody's wild about Leonardo now. I think they've had a decent run of fixtures, which has helped them a bit, but they are looking like a completely different team. He's settled on a formation now, which doesn't include Gattuso, controversially. He's having Ambrosini as his one defensive midfielder. And what he's doing is he's got Ronaldinho, who's managed to... He's managed to find a role for him which doesn't involve him running around too much. And Ronaldinho just basically sprays a couple of wise passes around and looks very sharp while doing it. Pato's playing really well. And I think the big thing is he's brought Borriello in up front, and Borriello's actually doing really well for them. I wanted to mention one other thing about Italy, but I can hear Sid Lowe banging his pots and pans in frustration there. So I'm going to come back to my Ascoli Regina story later on, because, as we all know, Sid Lowe throws a wobbly if he doesn't get what he wants. Sid!
Hello.
Hi, Sid. How are you doing there?
I'm sitting underneath a tram stop trying to escape the rain at the moment and listening to trams go past going bing, bing.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you for painting
nice.
That picture for us. Now,
on a bleak, grey industrial estate, so it's not particularly attractive picture, I'm afraid.
Why are you there, Sid?
Because I'm on my way home on the tram, and so as to guarantee that I could have a reception, albeit a pretty rubbish reception, and certainly not the ambassador's reception with Ferrero Rochers and all that, I had to get off the tram to make sure I could take the call, you see.
Wow, thanks, Sid.
So I'm sort of halfway home.
Right. Okay, now, I've lost my piece of paper telling me what... Oh, here it is. Right. Now, lots to talk about from the Spanish League. Barcelona and Real Madrid both winning. All sorts of excitement over here about Ronaldo lifting his shirt to reveal his new abdominals. Has that been a big story in Spain?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's been the biggest story in Spain. And as you kind of rightly hint there, I blame Ass. I think it's their fault. On Thursday, they ran that front page cover. Cristiano Ronaldo does 3,000 sit-ups a day. On Saturday, Cristiano Ronaldo scores a goal and obviously wants to prove to everyone that he does indeed do 3,000 sit-ups a day. So he takes off his shirt, kind of pulls
it. Does 3,000 sit-ups?
Well, he doesn't do 3,000 sit-ups, but he does kind of tense his stomach muscles and try and look extremely hard. Gets himself a yellow card, and then shortly afterwards gets himself another yellow card for swiping out an opposition player. Actually, could possibly even have been direct red that. Gets sent off, and that's created a little bit of a storm because there's quite a lot of people saying that his behaviour was disgraceful. And as you can imagine, there's also the flip side of that of people riding to his rescue and reminding them that plenty of other geniuses in the world of football have been sent off as well.
Right, interesting.
But it is from the Spanish point of view, it is that maybe an ever so slightly worrying first glance, or first glimpse, better word to use, of course, of a player that they fear maybe is playing for himself. And of course, I think a lot of people could have told them that anyway, because bear in mind there's a series of other factors in this. It's not just the fact that he got himself sent off basically pretty stupidly, but also that he took the penalty, which led to Real Madrid taking the lead 3-2, having been behind, and he took the penalty and missed it. Benzema scored from the rebound, and Ronaldo didn't celebrate because he was more pissed off at the fact that he'd missed the penalty than he was happy at the fact that his team was now going to win this match. So then when he added the fourth to make it 4-2, he then celebrated, and the fear is, of course, that celebration was all about him and not all about his team.
Right. See, that's it. Very interesting. And, of course, Real Madrid have a huge game coming up on... Is it Wednesday, I believe, no?
They should be safe, Real Madrid, in so much.
But if they lose a Milan win, does that not mean that they're out?
They need to lose 3-0, Real Madrid, to go out.
Okay.
Against Olympique Marseille. Now, I don't think it would be a huge surprise if Real Madrid were to lose to Olympique, but I think losing 3-0 is too much.
All right, Barcelona at Kiev. Again, there's some doubt there about qualifying, isn't there?
Yeah, it's in Barcelona's hands, but there is a certain degree of doubt. I must say, I don't have the table in front of me right now, but it is in Barcelona's hands, and they should still go through, I think, so long as they don't lose and the other result doesn't go against them.
Right, Barcelona are on 8 points. Inter and Rubin Kazan are both on 6 points, and Dynamo Kiev are on 5 points.
So in other words, they would have to lose and Inter would have to win as well for both Inter and Rubin Kazan to finish above Barcelona.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Or Dynamo Kiev would finish level with Barcelona. It's all too complicated. Let's assume they won't do that. Now, let's just move on to my other thing I wanted to ask you about, which is, what's this story about Real Madrid finding another 50 million quid down the back of their sofa for 50 million euros, for Cesc Fabregas?
Well, it's Real Madrid, so I think it's probably more a chaise longue than a sofa, isn't it? With great big bundles of opulence lying around the place. This is something that's been coming for a while, in so much as Real Madrid's interest in Cesc Fabregas, of course, is significant anyway, simply because he's seen as a very attractive proposition as a summer signing. He's seen as an available proposition for summer signing. There's a belief, I think, fairly widespread in Spain now that Fabregas is playing his last season at Arsenal. And I'm sure you there will be able to tell me better whether or not that's true than I can tell you from here. And there is also a couple of other really important factors from a political point of view that makes Cesc Fabregas an attractive signing for Florentino Pérez, the Real Madrid president. And the first one is that, as with Kaká, Cesc Fabregas is a player that Ramon Calderon couldn't deliver. Mm. Ramon Calderon, remember, won the Real Madrid presidential elections on the basis of a promise of signing three players, Cesc, Robin and Kaká. Only one of them turned up, which was Robin, and he turned up a year late and then spent most of his time injured. So that it would be a really good move from Florentino Pérez from that point of view. And then there's another key factor, of course, which is that there's an assumption that Cesc Fabregas will be a key part of any presidential battle at Barcelona. So Florentino Pérez would feel like not only had he put one over on Ramon Calderon, he would also feel like he'd put one over on Barcelona, which is about as good as you can expect right now, because buying a player off Barcelona, as he once did with Luis Figo, these days is impossible.
Right. And what about Barcelona's off-stated desire for Robinho? Still a current story?
Well, I was talking to someone at Barcelona the other day about this, and the very strong feeling now is, and I must say I was quite surprised about this, is that Barcelona will not sign in the winter transfer window. And I think that really does put a dampener on the situation with Robinho, because my feeling was that Barcelona were a little concerned about the price, but needed to get some sort of solution in the short term, and would have offered Manchester City the chance to give them Robinho for 6 months on a loan deal and say, and if we like him, we'll buy him in the summer. Now, I've now been told that the current feeling is that they don't want to go into the transfer market in January. So to some extent, that seems to have slowed a bit. And it is also true that the Catalan press are backing away a little bit from this story. So I suspect, and I don't know this for sure, that there's been some sort of conversations, and somewhere along the line, they've decided actually Robinho is not right, which raises a question. Is he not right because they've got someone else lined up?
Kevin, you're wondering about the Ascoli Regina story down in the second division.
Playing in my mind.
Right. Well, it's a curious business, really, because there are so reports that they're even under investigation, Ascoli, for having allowed their opponents to score a goal in the spirit of fair play, a bit like that Chesterfield story in the FA Cup last year. What happened was one of the Regina players, Valdez, he pulled up injured and tried to kick the ball off, you know. But an Ascoli player intercepted it, set up his own player, and they scored. At which point, the Regina players go a bit bonkers, and there's a bit of pushing and shoving. And in fact, this fellow Somesi, who'd nicked the ball before it crossed the line, gets hit, and the player who hit him gets sent off. But anyway, after all this argy-bargy, the Ascoli players go over to their manager and say, look, we look like real so-and-sos here. What should we do? And Beppe Pilon, the Ascoli manager, says, well, let them score. So they did. They stood by and let them score, and went on to lose 3-1, after which their fans, 400 of their fans, barricaded them inside the locker room, and they couldn't get out for about 2 hours because the fans were incensed at this act of fair play, possibly influenced by the fact that the fellow who originally went down, Valdez, as soon as Somesi had wandered off with the ball and set up his player, was himself on his feet racing down to complain. So there you go. But apparently the Italian Federation are investigating this, the fact that they stood by and let the opposition score, and Beppe Pilon's making all sorts of comments.
Surely it's a case that sportsmanship and football don't mix. They never have. I mean, since football became professional.
Well,
you know, it's a nasty business, football, hasn't it?
Pilon makes the point that this is something you can do in other countries, and there's no problem with it. But Italy, perhaps the culture of the sporting culture, I think is the phrase he used, isn't developed enough.
So when Juve was being helped by every referee on the planet, investigation, right? That reminds me of
an investigation.
Yeah.
They nailed them in the end.
Years later,
I'd like
right?
to see other leagues do the same.
Years later. But anyway, it reminds me of the story of the lion, you know, the kid and his grandfather in the zoo, and they see a lion and the lioness in the cage, and the lion is basically climbing on the lioness, and the kid asks the grandfather, what happened there? Grandfather said, well, what happens is that the lion hurt his leg, so the lioness is actually helping him. And the kid looks and says, right, that's why my dad says, if you ever help somebody, you're going to take it up the ass.
Fernando Duarte, I'm so glad we invited you back. Now, that's fantastic. That was my story, Kevin. I hope that satisfied you. Thanks, Fernando. Right, you just wait till part three when we get onto your stuff. I'll bring in my colourful, folkloristic grandpa's tales about wildlife fornicating in zoos and stuff. Anyway, that's it for part two, I believe. Is that right? And then in part three, we have Post and Fernando Duarte on all sorts of stuff, including the World Cup draw. We might even have a very special extra guest in part three as well. Stand by for that. Now, some tweets and posts. Here's one from DY158. For Duarte, how is Brazil's World Cup group being received? How do they regard it back in Brazil? Is it a group of death or not? Wait, Fernando, we'll come to that in a second. Go on, tell us now. What are they saying in Brazil about it?
Well, in Brazil, we consider that a group of death in comparison to the groups we played before in World Cups. It's like two difficult teams ahead of us. Portugal, the eternal former colonial masters rivalry. We beat them once. We lost them once in the last 2 years. Ghana, they must be gutted with what happened in the last World Cup and they won our scalp. But North Korea, not really a problem, but you never know. Brazil tends sometimes to really complicate themselves against, you know, smaller opposition.
Okay, right. I think Brazil have to fancy themselves to get something against North Korea, don't they?
In theory, yeah. In practice, I've seen Brazil struggle against Estonia, so, you know.
But Brazil have got a very solid run of results behind them. They may not be the most spectacular freewheeling Brazilian side we've ever seen, but they do seem to have found a form and a very effective one as well.
Well, do I think we're going to qualify? Yeah, I think we're going to qualify on 9 points.
Yeah.
Perhaps with a draw, so maybe 7, but I don't see a problem in qualifying this.
What's the mood like in Brazil regarding your prospects for the World Cup overall?
Well, people are excited. Of course, you're always going to have people mumbling, oh, this is not a vintage Brazil side. But for a vintage side, you need vintage players, which I think nobody in the world has got vintage players. Now, even Spain, in a certain way, nobody has got an amazing side capable of entertaining, etc. Even Spain are going to have to play pragmatic if they want to win the World Cup. Forget it, this kind of fantasista thing is not going to happen anymore. And the sooner we wake up in Brazil for that, the better. We got an amazing team that has been beating everybody. You know, we won every competition under Dunga. And if we win the World Cup on penalties again, why not? You know, that's fine. At the end of the day, one of the best Brazilian sides ever, the 1982 squad, entertained the world and still went home empty-handed.
Yeah.
And a whole generation of players was crucified.
But still, Fernando,
that.
I'm surprised to hear you saying that all this fantasista stuff doesn't work and Spain are going to have to knuckle down and Brazil should do too.
Because everybody's going to put people behind the ball.
Yeah.
You know, it's even Spain needed to go on penalties in the Euros, didn't they?
Against Italy,
It's evidence enough that a very organized side can kill fantasy, unfortunately. Unless we start like having different rules for football, like 10 players or something like that. Mm. The space are being reduced because everybody's an uber athlete these days.
Right, aren't they all? Mm. Apart from James Beattie, of course.
Yeah, of course.
On the subject of the World Cup, of course, we do have a World Cup draw special, video special, that's up and available on the site at the moment, featuring the collected thoughts of, David Pleat and Barry Glendinning, and why not, Kevin McCarra too. Simplicigans, can I be the first to say that the drawing of the England and the USA together equals the group of debt? Ooh, a little bit topical there. I tell you what, speaking of posters and the like, we do have an actual live poster in the studio with us. Villa Support Group, it is he. Congratulations, Villa Support Group and Mrs. Villa Support Group.
Oh, yes, thank you. I have my ring here and everything. So,
oh, fantastic. Yeah. Nice to see you keep it on when you're traveling.
Yes, don't take it off. There are many, many beautiful women in London. It goes against the stereotype, but she'll be glad
what
to
know. What stereotype is that?
There's the North American stereotype about English women.
Fantastic.
I don't know. I've never heard the stereotype.
Well, it's the teeth and the there's just this big thing in America about English. It's not true though.
What's the stereotype about the teeth?
It's the good dental work and everything.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. We are cornering our guests.
Kevin, you're sitting in that seat because Kevin McCarra has actually left to go to the dentist.
Well, does that not illustrate his point a bit?
Well, he's having some expensive dental work, so he still looks beautiful.
I'm going to ask you not to mention our stereotype about what American women look like.
In defense of our guest,
yes.
By the way, nice to meet you. We had the same impression about English women in Brazil, remember?
Really?
Yeah, because we're also the world champions in beautiful women. I am happily married to an English wife.
Yes.
And I must say, I love the clumsy elegance of English women. They are beautiful.
How can you say clumsy elegance?
Because they really, really dress nice, but it always seems they're going to fall down because they walk really clumsy. But I love that. I am in love with English women, although married faithfully to one English woman.
All right.
English women walk clumsily and have terrible teeth. This is what the world sees.
Stop it, Bunny. You're getting me hot. Now. Sorry, Richard. Thank you so much for going. Richard Whittle, by night known as Villa Support Group. I wanted to know what they were saying in North America about the group you've drawn with Algeria and England, and is it Slovakia?
It's Slovenia.
Slovenia.
Yeah. It's if you got in trouble for getting a Dutchman to comment on American soccer, you're going to get even more trouble because I'm actually Canadian.
Oh, you're Canadian.
That's right. So, but the CONCACAF group tends to stick together. So
right.
I actually am going for the United States against my better judgment on this draw.
How do you mean?
Well, the first thing I noticed when I came through the London airport was all the papers talking about the draw, and they, of course, all said England wins. This is going to be such an easy start. And as someone who's actually watched the U.S. through CONCACAF qualifying and also during the Confederations Cup last year, they're actually they're a team that tends to do really, really well now in major situations.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I think you're right. I think we have slightly underestimated the US in terms of what a good team. I think it's just that they're the kind of team who doesn't tend to beat England. I'd fear a team who nursed the ball and kept it from you. And I mean, the US are basically a bit like a slightly worse version of England. They're very athletic, right, and they attack you quite directly. And we don't fear those kind of teams particularly.
Well, I mean, it's sort of a, obviously in a major World Cup situation, it can cause problems. But you know, it does work. It worked against Spain, obviously, who you know, they played sort of an open game, and it ended up working. And it almost worked against Brazil, and then obviously Jesus. Collapsed. And there are going to be some problems because obviously there's a major injury list right now, and we don't know how that will work for the summer. But you know, if all goes well, I mean, obviously it doesn't matter that much in the group stage if England and the U.S. you know, can go through, then it might not matter that much in the end. But I think the first game should be really, really interesting. I think England tends to be pretty nervous starting, and obviously the spotlight and the pressure is going to be on them because America is going to be perceived as the underdog. So I think it could be a really, really interesting game.
Did it get a lot of coverage in the States? I don't know if there was a big Scrabble tournament or anything going on this
in
weekend.
The States. Well, it was funny. A friend of mine posted up the England headline, and it was, I think, from The Sun or something, and it said,
easy.
Yanks a lot, you know, sort of saying this was a good draw. And then he's also took a picture of the New York Times front page, and on this tiny little blurb right at the bottom of the newspaper, you saw America gets like a really good group as well. So I think both sides of the pond, they sort of think it's an easy draw. There won't be much media coverage now because the draw isn't taken as seriously, I think, in some parts of the States. Certainly within soccer communities, it was pretty massive. But the build-up to this cup is going to be very, very big. And I think this was probably the biggest World Cup for the United States in their history.
What, absolutely. Even more than the one that they had in...
Even the more than one, because I think this team is a lot stronger than previous ones. And I think, you know, just in terms of MLS development and because of Beckham playing with the LA Galaxy, I think the profile of the first match will... Well, and I think it's going to be live on ABC on a Saturday in the afternoon, which is a primetime slot for sports. So I think it'll be a big tournament. Yeah.
Is David Beckham really a big deal? I mean,
it depends who you talk to. He's not that big deal outside of the sort of major ESPN stuff, but I mean, he's a big deal in that sense that he's a bit of a joke, but yeah.
Right. Now, I have to say we could talk about this for ages, but we have two issues. One is the fact that Fernando Duarte is beginning to look like a lion who needs a hand and, you know, hot, under the cover or something.
No, it's just because
secondly,
I can't stand David Beckham anymore.
Right. All right. Well, listen, this is meant to be your Brazil corner. Fernando, I mentioned two. The other fact is that the Sounds Jewish podcast team are due to take over our airwaves. Well, actually, 3 minutes ago. So apologies to you if you are a Sounds Jewish listener who is waiting.
Don't worry
for
about it. Sounds Jewish. They're very stoical.
All right. Okay. Now, Fernando, what didn't happen this weekend? Oh, that's a rhetorical question. I mean, everything happened this weekend. You had the end of the Brazilian championship. And at the top, first of all, Flamengo. They win their first title for 17 years.
Yeah, and that's why my voice is... kind of Rod Stewart this today. I mean, it was amazing. I'm a huge Flamengo fan, as some of the listeners might remember. And Flamengo managed to break a duck of 17 years and also be the first Rio team to win the league in 8 years, and also the first to win the league under the league format. Beforehand, the Brazilian before 2001, the Brazilian championship used to be played in some kind of like playoff style. And then Flamengo managed to sneak five titles by doing mediocre campaigns and then, you know, winning the knockout stage, but this time they basically managed to be the best team, really. And the funny thing is, at the middle of the championship, they were lying down in ninth place, eighth place, and all of a sudden they had everything together working for them and won in the last round when four teams actually were within a shot of the title. They beat Grêmio 2-1. Funny thing, a reserve Grêmio side that basically could have just given the game away because Inter, their local rivals, were also in contention. So, but they played really, really well. They scored first, and almost 84,000 people in Maracanã had a heart attack on that. But they managed to win. Fantastic result. It doesn't mean the Rio football is out of jail, because Botafogo and Fluminense only managed to escape on the last round relegation, and Vasco was in second division. So that means that even though everything was out of place, you can still put in a decent campaign. But that means that with more organization, Rio teams would be winning more and more.
All right, excellent. Adriano, figuring very prominently in Flamengo's success, or I should say Mengo's success, joint top scorer with 19 goals.
Yeah, he resuscitated for football, in my opinion.
Resuscitate him for every match.
Yeah.
Does that take long?
No, I mean, he's a different guy from what you've seen before.
Is he?
Yeah.
He's got a bit of a spark there.
You know, there's more responsibility. He's not like the child anymore. I think it's a bit too early to say if he can make it to the World Cup. I think he deserves a space within the squad. Of course, Fabiana Neumar are the top choices for there, and also Rabinho. But Adriano deserves a chance.
Right.
Is there any way
Pato would get a look in or not?
Well, Dunga doesn't seem to like Pato. That's a problem. But it all depends on how Pato is going to be featuring for Milan. But it was interesting to see such a good player like Adriano actually loving football again.
Right.
Shame that he doesn't have a right foot. He could have scored a hat trick yesterday, but he insisted on putting the ball on his left. And, you know, that. Oh, I don't need to do an ECG anymore, because if I didn't die last night of a heart attack, I won't anymore. So.
Well, that's excellent news, Fernando. Adriano's scoring 19 goals. Does it count in Brazil? Is the defending really shocking, or is it actually really impressive?
Oh, the level of Brazilian football has decreased a lot. The thing is, it's not that we're selling the best players anymore.
No?
We're selling everybody. The Silva Twins, for example, never played a match for the top Fluminense team, for the adult side. So people are going everywhere in the country. I even wrote a book about it, of how many people are going to like non-traditional football places, to Vietnam, Indonesia. So the level is down, but to the point where Ronaldo can actually play. Even though he's got like a beer belly bigger than mine. So it is something. 19 goals, it is something. It shows a lot, because things are really balanced. But it's not that he's going to come back to Italy and be on that level again.
Right,
there's no
okay.
guarantees.
Now, down the other end of the table, the final day saw all sorts of drama at Curitiba down south. They were taking on Fluminense, and a 1-1 draw meant that Curitiba went down, and then all hell broke loose.
Yeah, it's a shame that Curitiba, some readers might remember seeing at the Guardian website the famous picture of the fireworks in Brazil. Mm. Curitiba was celebrating their 100th anniversary.
It's kind of a model city for Brazil.
Yeah, it's a model city in terms of organization, infrastructure, and even crime. It's in the south. We call them the Germans, because they're like, they had this German organization in comparison to the rest of Brazil. Unfortunately, they've also got ultras like in Italy. They got like some hardcore supporters, a young fan base that basically got really pissed off when they were relegated. And hell broke loose.
They invaded the pitch.
The police was overwhelming. Let me say that there should have been more policemen there for such a sensitive match. It was ugly. A policeman was killed. There are reports of a policeman killed outside the stadium. One was knocked unconscious in front of live television, and I think that doesn't show a good picture for Brazil for the next World Cup
right.
holders. I think the Brazilian FA has to take decisive steps on this, perhaps close the whole stadium for the season, because we cannot show that this behavior cannot be condoned. I mean, we don't have a good way to actually control our fan base. We need to start doing something on that. But the English example is actually that maybe there are ways that you can do that without waiting for a tragedy.
Yeah.
So that's the example, what they did. It is possible to reorganize things. And I think Brazil, before something really, really bad happens there, this kind of behavior needs to be repressed.
Well, as you say, with the World Cup coming up, not the kind of thing that anybody wants happening. Very, very good. Well, listen, that's it. We are out of time. So many, many thanks to Fernando for joining us today. Lovely to see you again.
So it's a pleasure to be here. I must say, what a 2009. Flamengo wins the championship. Rio wins the Olympics. I meet Paul McCartney, and my wife is pregnant. I mean, if my baby is a boy, he's going to be called Zico, perhaps.
Right, so. Okay. Interesting order of events there. Barney Rone, many, many thanks for joining us as well.
Thanks, James.
And you, Richard Whittle.
Yeah, sorry to make the pod jump the shark here, but there it is.
No, we left that particular cetacean. Is it a cetacean? I think we cleared the cetacean many years ago, Richard, but thanks for your concern anyway. We're off out of here. We are going to be back on Thursday with our reaction to this decisive final group round of the Champions League and much, much more. So join us for Football Weekly Extra then. Hello from all of us here. It is. Goodbye.
Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.